card for us to sign.
Right, we're on page 268.
We were going to go to Hateful.
The Cedres Balosco.
What page?
Page 268. In the Feldheim Chumash. With English. So this cedra, it's a very rich cedra in the sense of many different subjects dealt with in the cedra. The beginning of the cedra is very full of meaning because it's telling us about a very short paragraph about the menorah. Remember where we are in the story.
Am I on the right page?
Yes, yes. That's the one. Where we are in the story is that the Jewish people came out of Egypt. For the first 7 weeks they were preparing for the giving of the Torah. Then the Ten Commandments were given on Shavuot. Then Moses went up the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights to learn the Torah. He was due to bring the tablets down, the two tablets with the Ten Commandments on them, on the 17th of Tammuz. Unfortunately, they served the golden calf. He went up again for another 40 days and 40 nights to pray for their survival. Then he went up again for another 40 days and 40 nights to get the second lot of tablets, second pair of tablets, and came down on Yom Kippur.
Is that right?
The day after Yom Kippur, God gave the Jews the command to make the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the desert, and that took them another nearly 6 months.
I thought this happened around Pesach and Shavuot.
Correct. By the time it came to Rosh Chodesh Nissan of the second year, by then the Mishkan was erected, and they had the opening ceremony on the first day of Nissan. And then, in this week's Sedra, we have the account about the Pesach Sheni. That Pesach, only 2 weeks later, they brought a Pesach lamb and celebrated Pesach again for the second year. And there were some people who were impure and were unable to participate in the sacrifice, and they complained, and God gave them the mitzvah of the second Pesach, which is on the 14th of the year. That's all in this week's Sedra. So that's where we are in the story. The Mishkan, the tabernacle, has just been put up, and the Nesiim, the princes, the 12 tribes, have given their unbelievably generous gift to the temple, to the tabernacle, for the first 12 days of Nisan. Each one of them gave their gifts. And at the end of that time, Aaron felt somewhat, I won't say aggrieved, but somewhat upset. Because he felt that his tribe, the tribe of Levi, and because the Kohanim, the priests, come from the tribe of Levi, was not properly represented in the dedication ceremony and the opening ceremony of the tabernacle. The 12 tribes, their princes had each brought these magnificent gifts, and he and the Kohanim, there were only five Kohanim at the time, he and his four sons, and the rest of the tribe of Levi, they were not involved. They were involved in the dedication ceremony. They were involved in bringing sacrifices to prepare themselves and be dedicated in role as being priests, but in terms of the opening ceremony, where all these wonderful gifts were given, they did not participate. So Aaron felt very upset, and in a way deprived. So God gave this law of the menorah. And this is how the Seder begins, because it's the Kohen that lights the menorah. The menorah is not the Hanukkah menorah, but the temple menorah, which is seven branches, not eight. The original menorah, It was made for the tabernacle in the desert.
Can I ask you a question?
It's on in every store, isn't it?
You very often get a...
Not on, I mean the sale.
You very often get a model or a picture of it or a window with it. With
that's
a
it.
It's not on there.
That is it? Yeah, yeah. Although there are differences of opinion as to what the shape of the arms...
That was the shape, do they?
Well, that's one opinion, that it was round arms. Brother Maimonides, his opinion is that they were straight arms.
Like that.
They were diagonal arms.
Mm. Yeah.
So what's the eternal light then?
The eternal light was on the menorah. It was one of the lamps of the menorah which never went out. And that's called the Ner Tamid. And that is commemorated in synagogues by having an eternal light burning in front of the Aron HaKodesh, in front of the Holy Ark. So this is the introduction to the Sedra. So Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lemar, God spoke to Moses saying, Daber el Aaron v'amata elav, speak to Aaron and say to him, Ba'aloshes aneiros, when you raise up the lamps, el mul pnei amenorah yirishios aneiros, it should be done towards the face of the menorah, which when you light up the seven lamps. So there were seven lamps on the candelabrum, seven arms, one central, shall we say, trunk. You know, if you take your tree analogy, it's vaguely like a tree. And then there were three arms on either side. So those are the seven. So he says that when you light the candles, it was made of oil. Correct? So that Rashi explains that he was to make the wick's face towards the central light. So the central light was vertical, and the wicks on the three wicks on either side were at 45 degrees, right? And they were pointing towards the center. Some commentaries say that even the flame miraculously burned at 45 degrees instead of vertically upwards. It was a miracle. But the idea was to show how all the different ways all go up through one central point, and it's expressing and stressing the unity which is there within the Jewish people, because the menorah represents the whole gamut of the Jewish people, the range of opinions, the right wingers, the left wingers, the rightists and the leftists, the people who are very kind and generous, and the people who are more restrained and restricted, and everything in between.
The E.coli villagers.
And what, sorry?
The E.coli village.
Is this, do you think, a fairly good rendition of what?
Well, I don't know. I haven't got time to look through it now, but it looks pretty good. You found it?
No, I picked it up somewhere. It's got skins over the top. Is that how it's described?
Yes, it had. Indeed, it had skins over the top.
Have a look on the front.
Yes, yes. This looks pretty good. Yeah.
Sort of an artist's impression.
Yeah. It's a model that somebody's made. Mm. Yeah, there were various skins on top. And it was very colourful. We know there was blue wool and purple wool and scarlet yarn and white. So it was an extremely colourful temple or tabernacle.
Oh no,
that was the outside culture. So this is the instruction to Aaron. Vayas kain Aaron el mul panei amenorah helon el. Aaron did so, and he raised up the lights to the center of the menorah. He calls it literally the face of the menorah, which Rashi explains is the center. Kasha tziva Hashem es Moshe, as God commanded Moshe. So Rashi explains that we can learn a lesson from Ba'aloscha Saneiros. Ba'aloscha means when you will raise up. Why doesn't it use a simple word of Ba'adlikcha Saneiros? You know the bracha that we make when we light the Shabbos candles? Lahadlik.
Ne'eshel Shabbat.
Very good. And the same with Hanukkah. Lahadlik, ner, shel Hanukkah, or ner Hanukkah, according to other versions. So lahadlik in Hebrew, hadlaka, means to kindle. So why does the Torah use another word than kindle, and it uses the word when you raise up the lights? So Rashi brings two explanations. And the first one is that it's to teach us, to teach Aaron, that he has to keep the taper in position until the flame is fully at its maximum extent. You know when you first light a candle flame?
It's a little flame.
It's a small blue flame to start with. And then it, like, you know, it has to gather strength and heat up. And then the flame gets a bit bigger and a bit bigger and bigger until it's the size of, you know, about an inch long. And then it goes yellow. Although there is a dark coloured flame near the wick. But it takes a while, you know, seconds, before it actually is strong enough to burn of its own accord. So if you just touch the wick and move away, you'll get this effect of the flame struggling to establish itself. So Baloses Aneros means when you will raise up the lights, Aaron was told to keep the taper that he was using to light the flame there until the flame is fully established and at its maximum extent. So he's raising up the flame.
Now, didn't they still have the tallow or the wax for the candles? Or
they use oil, olive oil.
I think they used oil, of course.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a difference, then they had to wait a while.
Well, the wick was in a bowl, a largish bowl, because the oil had to burn right through the night and something of the next day as well. So they used quite a lot of oil. So the cup was quite a large cup and the wicks were quite big. So there was a wick in the centre of the bowl that was holding the oil, and he held the taper there until the flame... I mean, an oil flame is a perfectly good flame, equivalent to a candle flame.
I should think so.
It's not weak in any way. I mean, I know this from Hanukkah because I use oil for Hanukkah. And usually the size of the flame depends on the size of the wick. So if you make the wick a bit longer, you get a bigger flame. So that is the lesson that Rashi tells us that was an instruction to Aaron. Now, it's also a lesson for us in another context, which is that this idea of lighting a flame and the flame burns of its own accord has been compared to education. Because in education, we are trying to transmit to the next generation the knowledge and the enthusiasm and the interest and the conviction and the determination to go on with Judaism. Well, I mean, that's true of Judaism in particular. I mean, education generally has got that goal, is to impart knowledge and the interest in in that knowledge to the next generation. If you teach a child knowledge, but you don't interest them to get involved with that knowledge, then there's been something of a failure there. So, for example, in school we find that kids may major in different subjects. So you'll get them majoring in science or in arts or in languages or something. And you very often find that the things they've learned in the subjects that they didn't major in, it's like water off a duck's back. You know, they did a bit of chemistry, but ask them what chemistry is all about in 5 years after they've left school and they've majored in French or German. They won't know they won't remember very much. And they're certainly not interested in it. So education has got to be a double act. It's an act of imparting knowledge, but more importantly, it's an act of infusing the pupil or the one that's being educated, it doesn't have to be a young person, it could be an older person as well, with the energy and the ambition to run with that knowledge and put it into practice and go on learning for themselves. So this is the example that Rashi is giving over here. With a flame, if you just touch the flame and it's struggling to establish itself, that in a certain sense is a failure of communicating the flame from one wick to the other, because the second wick is struggling and it might actually fail, it might actually go out. So the same thing with education. When we're dealing with children, usually it's with children, but it could be adults as well, the idea is to impart knowledge, but also impart enough enthusiasm that they should be self-starters. And this, in Hebrew, it's there's an example used, given for this, in the laws of Shabbos. It talks about the wetness of a cloth. And it says, you can have a cloth that's so wet that it, when it touches another cloth, it makes the other cloth wet as well, and so wet that that will wet a third cloth. That's called tefeach al menas latfiach. It's so wet, it'll make another thing wet, and so wet that it'll make a third thing wet. So the education has to get the children involved to the extent that when they grow up, they will want to impart it to their children and their educatees. If you'll excuse me inventing a word.
Talking of educators, you know who came to the Brenner Centre today? I recognised him at once. Clive Lawton.
Yes, and he was in Lubavitch today, and I spoke to him.
What was he doing around here?
He runs every year, it's a JCC, and they have a guided tour by Clive Lawton of Stamford Hill.
Can you tell in short, Michelle, who he is?
He's a writer, he's a public figure.
You'd like him, he's got a ponytail.
Yeah.
Do you know?
So he came to Lubavitch first, and they spent an hour over here.
Oh. Well, he's on a conventional front.
Yes.
Would he be an admirer of Shlomo Carliver?
I've no idea what his personal views are.
Please ask a question, sorry.
You know, Rabbi Sochert, he speaks at different places, but he never comes to Stamford Hill. Why doesn't he do that?
You'll have to address your question to Rabbi Sochert.
It's in Mill Hill.
He goes to all those places, but he doesn't come to us.
I suppose he's got
who's
to
us?
Stamford Hill.
Who you want to come to?
Stamford Hill.
He's very popular, apparently.
He is.
Mill Hill. He's also Lubavitch, do you know?
I do know. And I've heard him speak, haven't I? Me and Beth heard him speak when we went to the Inspire. He's wonderful. Sure. But I mean, I'd like to hear him speak again, but he never comes this way.
Invite him.
He has some cure on a Wednesday evening because in Mill Hill.
Invite him to speak.
Do you think his family were Shochets?
Very likely. Okay, so let's continue the point. This is the way that the menorah was made. It was beaten from gold. It is from base to tip, where there were flowers. There was a flower design on along the tip. And the whole thing was one solid piece of gold. Kamara Ashehera Hashem is Moshe Kenos as a menorah. And this is a vision, like the vision, which God showed Moses. That's the way the menorah was made. Rashi explains that Moses, although he saw the menorah, he had great difficulty in actually making it. Because it's an extremely ornate design, as you can see from the picture. He saw it. God showed him a vision of it. Yeah. So that was the design of it. But that was not sufficient to enable him to do it. It was so intricate. I mean, there are limitations in how you make the menorah, because you're not allowed to lose any of the weight. Well, you start off with this weight of gold, and it's in a block shape, and only, not by cutting, but by shaping, extruding and shaping and knocking, but not cutting, without losing any of the weight, they had to shape this gold. Now gold, it's true, is soft, but it was so intricate that Moshe could not do it. And according to some opinions, God miraculously made it. He did it himself. So that's why it says it was like the vision which God showed Moshe. Cain also has a menorah, so he made the menorah. But as Rashi says, it doesn't say who made it. And it leaves room for the explanation that says that God himself made it. Another point which is mentioned over here is that it says, Vayas Cain Aaron. Aaron did so. So Rashi says, Malamed, or Lahagid Shvacha Shal Aaron Shalai Shina. This is to tell us the praise of Aaron, that he did not make any change to the instructions that he was given. And many people ask the question, Why is that a praise of Aaron? Aaron was the brother of Moses. He was a godly man, and he would have had no incentive to disobey God's instructions. He was a tzaddik, a righteous man. A righteous man is defined as someone that obeys God's will at all times. So if Moses came along and said, right, Aaron, this is how you light the menorah, you must make the wicks like this, and you must light them like this, and you start over here, and you make sure the flame is completely up before you move on to the next wick, and this and this time, and this place. So is Aaron going to make any difference? Is he going to change anything? For sure not. So why does the Torah have to tell us that he, and his Rashi says, this is his praise that he did not change anything. So a comment or an explanation I heard a number of years ago is that Aaron, this is telling us not about the first day. The first day, for sure, anyone in the world that was given a task by God through Moses, the first day they would do it exactly as they're supposed to, full of interest, full of enthusiasm, full of the newness. Everybody's interested in something new. And that's the way it should be. The first day, the second day, well, it's still new. The third day, the fourth day, the fifth day. For the first week, it's all new. Like Hanukkah, you know, we light Hanukkah lights. And it's, you can keep the enthusiasm going for 8 days. But it comes towards the eighth day, you know, like, you know, a bit lighting, you get a bit used to it. You get a bit used to it, and you sort of lose a little bit of interest and lose a little bit of enthusiasm. And what would happen if this went on every single day for a month, and then for 6 months, and then for a year, and then for 2 years, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, 20 years? How do you think an ordinary person would approach the lighting of the menorah if they've been doing it every single day for 20 years? You know, when people are in jobs and they're doing the same thing every single day for 10 years, 20 years. At the end, you know, at the end of the time, they're getting tired and they say, oh, you know, when am I going to retire already? You know, this is, you know, I'm a machinist in a factory, or I'm making widgets or something. You get bored, you know, I've seen it all before. I've done it 1,000,000,000 times.
So to keep...
That is true, but that doesn't keep your interest, does it? You know, you do it in your sleep.
It does.
So here, this is telling us over here to tell us the praise of Aaron that he did not change even on the last day, his dying day, when he did it in the morning and he passed away in the evening or the afternoon, whenever it was. That morning, after 39 years of lighting the menorah, he still did it with enthusiasm, with interest, with a geschmack, as we say in Yiddish. A geschmack means a taste. It's geschmack, it's and tasty, it's good. You can't translate Yiddish words, they're too expressive. The English word sounds so tame in comparison. Geschmack.
I went to the homeless, taste. This lady, little dementia lady, she was playing some time, trying again. She was saying, Hapnis, isn't it? Hey, Seloction. But the others didn't know what she was talking about, the staff. They tried to undertake, make me translate what it meant.
Was Hapnis?
You know, grab it.
Don't grab it like hot
grab it like it's hot spaghetti. And I'm trying to explain it, but it wasn't the same.
Yiddish is untranslatable.
I knew exactly what she meant with all her mind.
It loses all the geschmack when you translate
it. It was beautiful the way she said it. She didn't know a lot, but she knew that. Happiness isn't a selection. It's like I sort of my mother would say.
Those were the days, but unfortunately, except amongst the Haredim of the so-called ultra-Orthodox around the world, Yiddish is a dying language. But they're keeping it going because all their schools and yeshivas are in Yiddish.
It's a shame about that because you can't...
Well, it's being maintained by the ultra-Orthodox.
And scholars learn it.
Yeah, but that's.
No, but they can teach it.
That's not going to keep it going, you know.
No, but they can teach it.
You know, Latin is still studied in university.
No, yes.
You wouldn't call it a living language.
No, but they can teach it.
Okay, let's try and keep focus.
They want you to know what they were talking about.
Yeah.
They used to speak in Yiddish.
Okay, let's move on a little. We're going to do, in the short time we have available, we'll learn a little bit about the second Passover. Page 269.
Is that the centre of this week?
It's in the centre of this week.
It's a bit late, isn't it?
The centre doesn't go according to the date.
Oh, no.
Chapter 9, verse 1. So I mentioned earlier about the context in which we're learning the Sedra, which is they're in the second year after leaving Egypt. They've just celebrated Pesach, and some people were upset. In order to understand their upset, we have to know a basic law, which is that we have this, the concept of purity and impurity. Yeah, we've discussed this many, many times. The basic kind of impurity that everyone knows about is contact with the dead. Not anything to do with hygiene, nothing to do with germs. We always have to say that because it's absolutely nothing to do with it. In other words, you don't even have to touch the dead body to be made impure. All one needs to be is in the same building as the body. And that already will make you impure. So it could be that someone's in hospital and there's a dead Jewish body in the morgue, in the basement. The whole hospital is one large ohel, which means a tent. It's like, it's got the law of a canopy or tent. It doesn't need to be a tent, it can be a building as we're saying, but that's the law of ohel. And everyone in that hospital is tameh, is impure. It doesn't apply to Gentiles.
What about an Orthodox Jewish person who goes to a hospital? Then he's made impure as well.
Yeah, that's true.
Same as anybody else, yeah.
Being tameh, being impure, it's nothing to do with Orthodoxy. It applies to all Jews, and irrespective of who they are, what they are. So,
and a Kohen.
A Kohen can become impure as well, but he's not allowed to. He's got to avoid it at all costs.
He mustn't go to a hospital then to visit.
He should avoid a hospital because it's highly likely that someone's... that it'll get caught by the fact... Maybe someone can die suddenly.
See.
And so Kohanim, unless they're in hospital for their own reasons, avoid visiting hospitals. If they know... Even if there's no morgue in the actual hospital, but someone might die on a ward.
Bound to be somebody that's dying.
Well,
bound to be. Somebody's dead, isn't it?
Yeah. So, the basic law says that someone that's in a state of impurity is not allowed to participate in a sacrifice. Now, the Pesach lamb is a sacrifice. So that means that if anyone's impure through contact with the dead, they can't sit down at the Seder with everyone else. And they can't participate in the lamb. We don't have it now because we don't have a temple. And that's what happened in that second year. They kept the Pesach, and there were some people who unfortunately were impure, and they realized they can't participate. What was their reaction? They didn't take a view of, well, what can you do, my friend? What can you do, my boy? You have to accept what you're told. You know, this is the way it is. That's a Jewish attitude. You know, what can I do? What can I do? What can you do? They did not say that. They went to Moshe. They went to Moses. And they said, it's not fair. Well, we want to join in. Why should we be worse off? And they wouldn't let go. They saw the whole Jewish people all together participating in a lovely, wonderful thing, the bringing of the Pesach lamb, sitting together with their families, with the Seder, with Matzah, and Maror, and the four questions, and the children, and they're excluded. They weren't allowed to even sit with them. because there's a danger they might stretch out their hand and touch the sacrifice and make it impure and no one else can eat it. So they weren't allowed in. So they never took no for an answer, and they stormed the gates, not literally, but they came to Moses and Aaron and said, Lomani Goya, why should we be worse off? They didn't shrug their shoulders and say, what can you do, my boy? So what happened? Moses knew that there's no way that they can be included. But he said, you know what? You have a good question. Maybe God has an answer for you. And he said, you stay here and I will ask God what we can do. And to his great amazement, God said, not that they can participate in the existing carbon, that's for sure not, that's a law. But God said, I'm going to give them an opportunity to bring the Pesach lamb again, meaning on another occasion, on the Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach, which is the 14th of Iyar, which is precisely a month after the first Pesach. Now what we learn from this is that these Jews were demonstrating, and this is what we were talking before about chinuch, education. When do you see the success of education? You see it when those that you are trying to educate want to follow the way that you have shown them for themselves. Not because they're being told to, but because they want to. Then you know you've succeeded with your education process. And this is something which we read later on in the Torah. Towards the end of the Torah it says that Moshe wrote a Sefer Torah for his tribe, the tribe of Levi, the Levites. And you know what happened? The other 12 tribes, they came storming to Moses and said, why don't we have a Sefer Torah? Why are you just saving your own tribe? He was a Levite as well. Why are you just giving? We want the Torah as well. And you know what? He wrote 12 Torahs for them. One for each tribe. And Rashi comments over there about the fact that Moshe was so happy. And he said, now I know that you have matured. Now I know you've come of age. Instead of me, I'm paraphrasing now, instead of me, that's Moses, you know, giving him over the head, do this, do that, do the other, why are you doing this, why are you doing that, walk here, go there, stop here, and giving them orders, and they're resisting. Some of them argued back. They did not show that they wanted it for themselves. They were just relying on the fact that Moses is guiding them. So you listen to the teacher. But when I grow up, I'm not going to do that, was their attitude possibly. But when they demonstrated that they wanted a Sefer Torah for themselves, that is the moment of success in education. Because now they're self-starters. That means they're so involved in it now that they will hand it on to the next generation. And the chain is secure. And that's what happened over here. God's response to them was in a kind of acknowledging their enthusiasm and saying, you know, it's because of your enthusiasm I'm giving you an extra law over here. Had they just taken no for an answer and ignored it, then very likely God would have just ignored it too. And there would not be a Pesach Sheni. It was the enthusiasm of the Jews that drew out from God this revelation that it's possible to bring another Pesach. And the previous Rebbe, I'm sure if you've heard me say this before, he said this is a lesson for all Jews, that we must not imagine for a moment that whenever we strayed or gone wrong or failed to do something, that that's the end of the story and you just close the book and that's the end of it. There's no other opportunities. No. This Pesach Sheni is telling us there's always another opportunity to right the wrong and to fulfill the omission. And that opportunity is always given. It's the concept of teshuvah, the concept of return, repentance, whatever you want to translate it. And every Jew has got this ability and is able to right the wrong and even revert and reverse wrongdoing that's been done in the past that seems to be totally historic. Once it's done, it's done. But Teshuvah has the capability and the power to even reverse wrongdoing that's been done in the past, not just from now into the future. So this is a powerful lesson that we learn from Pesach Sheni, and please God, we'll continue with the Sedra next week.